Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. Last week, we talked about Phantom Thread. Before that was Little Women, Parasite, and Uncut Gems. I've written a couple of things, and I have a book coming out called Content About Content. I'll post a link on our Twitter feed at some point. Yeah, let's get to it. James.
Yes.
Here we are.
Here we are. In
1931.
Yeah. 1931. German film. Fritz Lang. Mm-hmm. Simply titled M.
Yes.
Made it difficult when looking for podcasts to listen to about M. See what other people have been saying about it. But
yeah, it's easier to Google Fritz Lang 1931 than it is to find anything about this movie with the title.
It's true. Mm. But once you find it, there's a lot said about this movie because it's a very well-regarded, very famous movie.
Yes, absolutely. And as such, has been on our list for some time.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen it. I'd seen Metropolis. I kind of didn't know what I was getting into here. I knew it was a film about a child murderer, which indeed it is.
The rumors check out.
Yeah, that checks out. I was very surprised watching this movie. In a few ways, I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this movie a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, no hot take there. It's considered a timeless classic and, you know, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And some people say one of the best films ever made, or maybe the best film that Germany's ever made, which is an important film in international cinema. And I thought it was really good. And I just thought it was it was going to be more of a sort of a whodunit, find out who this person is. And that's not the case. You kind of know who it is very quickly. They tell you who it is. But it kind of walks the line between a slasher serial killer movie and a police procedural, which, you know, in the time that's passed since, it's been credited with sort of creating both of those genres. And yeah, it was a very, very pleasant surprise for me. I mean, maybe pleasant's not the word to talk to them, but I was pleasantly surprised by how much I liked this movie and how contemporary it felt and just how many unexpected things came from watching it.
Yes, I agree for the most part. And specifically the first moment of this movie where I was just like, oh, this is incredibly modern, is the towards the beginning when the phone call is happening to the commissioner of the police after the press has published the Beckert's letter, who is the killer, Peter Lorre's character. And yeah, you go from that phone call to cut to, you know, the commissioner of the police says we're going to do fingerprint and handwriting analysis, cut to the fingerprint analysis, cut to the handwriting analysis, back to the conversation, cut to the candy wrapper investigation where they're searching. They find this candy wrapper and then search within 2 miles of any candy store in the radius, or a 2 mile radius or whatever. And then back to the conversation. And it's just like, outside of having like a Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score playing underneath it, it's like Gone Girl, you know, like it's really interesting. And it felt very modern, and also it was so it was legitimately like hard for me to follow because it didn't use any of the cues I've come to anticipate from movies made in 1931, because all of the cues were modern cues. And it was just like, it was this really bizarre thing that I had to wrap my head around. And I mean, this is as like a pleasant surprise for sure. Like, that was something that was really interesting. And then also I think the final big scene, that sort of trial scene, just for the most part feels incredibly modern.
Yeah. And I think sometimes when you watch an older movie, there is things that you are sort of expected to appreciate when you say, you know, even if something doesn't stand out at you at the time, you know, you do some reading, or if you have it explained to you that this was the first use of this, or this was really uncommon then, that that kind of allows you to appreciate a movie a bit more. But that didn't really seem necessary. You know, it's not just the innovation of this movie that makes it a good experience to watch. It's just on its own, out of context, is just I thought was a very compelling movie. And then you know compound that with the fact that these were very innovative. You know, even the use of fingerprinting and handwriting analysis would have been sort of cutting edge sciences at the time. But it really stands on its own. And then when you come to understand the way that this was very sort of progressive in its filmmaking, just makes it that much more interesting. But just in isolation, I thought it was just a very, very good watch on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. And as I said, it's not really a whodunit. You know, they sort of tell you who it is, and it's the excitement of it is watching whether they're going to catch this person in time before he can commit one more crime. But
yeah, which is also true with most really great serial killer movies. You know, like Seven and Silence of the Lambs. It's not who is the killer; it's let's catch the killer. You know, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And as you said, it does feel so modern throughout. So I think that those are good comparisons, that it's not just sort of this trick of, you know, answering this question is going to give you some sort of resolution to the movie. This movie is about really good filmmaking, but then, you know, by the end you find out it is sort of this meditation on free will and guilt and the, you know, the criminal justice system. But yeah, I'm sure we'll get to that, but we can sort of look at this more chronologically. As you said, it starts off with this murder, and then we have, a police investigation, and simultaneously we, you know, a bit later we get this idea that there's an investigation by the criminal underworld, because the police investigation is, it's so wide-reaching. You know, this is a child murderer in a major city, so... repeat child murderer, so a serial killer. So there is understandably a big push to catch this criminal and put an end to it, and that's getting in the way of normal criminal behavior, because as we see, their bars, their hangouts, they're being disrupted, and you know their life on the street is being their work on the street is being disrupted by this extremely prevalent police presence. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the arc of this movie is this killer is out of control. The police respond to it, and then the police response forces the criminals to take an even deeper interest in it. And you know, we watch these two forces try to get to our serial killer Beckert before the other one, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you describe it like that, I assume anybody listening to this podcast has seen the movie, you know, like when you describe it like that, it sounds more conventional than how it actually plays out. You know, there's no real main character to this movie. I think the only argument is really Beckert, right? Like, and even that's a pretty loose argument, I think.
And just to point out how odd that is, that's really the case in a serial killer movie, right?
Yeah,
we're always following a cop or a pair of cops or maybe the you know, a relative or a lover of one of the victims or something like that. But to either have no character, no protagonist, or essentially the antagonist be the character that we spend the most time with is unusual in itself.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing that really sort of sets it out of sort of a conventional feel is that there's not really a three-act structure to this movie. It's just sort of scenes that happen, and the movie just sort of goes in the way that I suppose Fritz Lang and his co-writer, whose name I am now looking up, Thea von Harbau.
His wife.
Yes, at the time. It just sort of goes in the direction that the movie feels like it should go. There's no adherence to act at all, and I always really appreciate that in a movie, and especially from this time period. I recognize my knowledge of film history isn't like stellar, but I don't know, this felt very unconventional for the time.
Yeah, and then to have it be Fritz Lang's first, you know, talkie, first non-silent film. That it still is sparse with sound for a lot of it. You know, there is some interesting sound design, and I think that there was this temptation when the innovation of having regular dialogue and a lot of sound came about that mm-hmm. now it's, you know, it's, since it's the new toy, let's play with it a lot. It's this new gimmick that we can exploit that is going to be relatively new for viewers. And my understanding that there's some budgetary reasons why there is somewhat sparse sound at certain points in this movie, but just to watch it now, it is interesting to see that they had the chance to do all this dialogue and all this sound design, and it's really not packed with it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you look at the history of like cinematic innovation, like with technology, something that's happened before our eyes is CGI. Like that's something that we've lived through, is the CGI revolution, right? And the movies that are notable for their technological use for that are ones that use it sparingly, right? So Jurassic Park is a real milestone in that. And you know, we've done a podcast on that as people who were like seven when that movie came out. We probably yeah. read authorized publications about the making of that movie, right? Like they combined animatronics with a little bit of CGI, right? Like there's not tons of CGI in Jurassic Park, and it's because they do these different things in the movie and they cover up the flaws in the new technology as best as they can. It creates a better experience. Whereas if you look at something that, you know, dove like Johnny Mnemonic or something like that, where they dive right into the use of CGI and use it a lot more. Virtuosity is another movie that's coming to mind with Denzel Washington. It just looks so much cornier, right? Because they're just like, let's just dive in all the way. And yeah. comparing the movie Virtuosity to Fritz Lang's M is very disrespectful to Fritz Lang. I apologize. But
let's do our Johnny Mnemonic podcast for more.
Yeah. And then we'll follow it up with a Lawnmower Man podcast. But the idea, I'm sort of trying to modernize the idea, and sound in 1931 is sort of almost a CGI of its time, in that it's the new technology, and it was a divisive technology. Like, you know, should we add movies to film? Add sound to film? Does that minimize the impact of the movie? To us, that sounds like a stupid question because we were raised watching movies with sound. But at the time, it was a real debate. And adding sound to a movie was difficult because it was new technology. And like you said, you suspected some budgetary issues are reasons why there's not more sound in this movie. But also, I think silence is used really well because this sound is used sparingly. Like they use sound when they have to. And then when they don't have to, they realize that going back to almost a silent sort of film idea can almost make this movie that's about a serial killer even more eerie, you know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And like the main two things that I think really are notable about this movie's use of sound are the way Beckert whistles, just that he has this sort of musical theme that follows him around. It's how he gets identified. I mean, we're talking about this sound film from 1931 where it's a new technology, and who identifies the killer? It's the person who can't see. It's the person who can only hear, right? Yeah. So it's important in that way, and that it's actually tied into the storytelling of the film, which is a cool idea. Because like, imagine this script is made as a silent film. You know, it's just like the blind man like is startled, and then you cut to a text card that says brackets, here's whistling or something, you know, like it just wouldn't work. And and I think that's really important, that Beckert isn't identified with eyes initially. He's identified with ears, or by somebody's ears. And there's ties in with the kids singing. Like we hear something in this movie before we see anything. Like the opening piece of sound is the kids singing, I think, and we hear a little bit of it before the screen even fades up. And after the screen is faded to black at the end, we hear one last line. And it's almost like sound exists before image in this movie. And I thought that was really interesting. And there's the line when Elsie's mom is talking to that woman who I don't think we ever really get a real identification, but presumably another mom. She's saying, as long as we can hear them singing, at least we know they're still there. You know, it's just these tie-ins are a really interesting way to use sound. Like, it's not just sound for sound's sake. It's not just, yeah, let's use this new technology. It's like, these are interesting ideas given the story that we're telling, and they make our story more interesting. And then to go back to the use of no sound when it's starting to become clear that Elsie is not coming home. We get all of these shots of, you know, that shot down the staircase after the mom is called down for Elsie. There's no response. There's nobody on the stairs. That shot of the clothes hanging in the attic, which is a really like kind of spooky shot. No sound. The place that the mother had been setting for Elsie at the table. It's like a place set for somebody who isn't there and will never be there. That shot of the ball rolling in the field, and then finally that balloon and the power lines. You know, like that sequence, all of those images are more haunting because the sound has dropped out, and there is like the sound of Elsie is gone. You know, the sound of the kids singing is gone, and it's not going to come back. You know, and I thought that was that's all in the first 10 minutes, and it's just this really interesting, thoughtful way to use sound right off the bat.
Yeah, no, it's, as you said, like, it's perfect that the sound isn't superfluous. It's not just there because we can do it now, as you said. It's tied into these very meaningful things. And a small thing I want to point out is when she is still, you know, not even hopeful because she's just, well, more expectant that Elsie's coming home, that she's just a bit later than, you know, the other kids, that she's not even worried yet. She's still kind of just setting the place a bit more carefully. You know, it's not nervous fidgeting. She's mm-hmm. just still like lovingly making sure that she's, you know, set this place out for her daughter and everything's perfect. And it's this really sweet domestic moment that, you know, as we quickly learn, is not going to be received. But I thought it was just this really, really nice thing. And it could have been more, you know, she's more nervous at that point, but it's really just this very loving mother being a loving mother for her daughter. And you're right, we get I think it's that first 10 minutes ish as you pointed out, I think it's great. I think it's really tight. They do so much with so little. You know, they set the scene, we get that the children singing that sort of eeny meeny miny moe elimination song with very very dark lyrics, you know, the way that kids do, or I mean, I think kids used to do more, and I'm sure from 1930 did even more than when we were young, which is more than I think they do now. And so we kind of set these themes of, you know, there's this childish sort of playfulness with these very darker themes. Just her bouncing her ball off the, you know, the notice about this killer and the reward sign and all that stuff. You know, there's this obliviousness to the darkness that is sort of all around these kids, and we see that, as you said, with the way that Elsie's mother's neighbor says, you know, is talking about them singing, and at least if you can hear them, they're there. You know, it's this very, you know, extremely heavy themes of murder and abduction of children, but you know, it's these kids are just outside in the street having fun and bouncing balls and, you know, playing this game and stuff. And it's just a really tight 10 minutes that does so much heavy lifting without it really feeling super expositional.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one other thing that ties both of our points together here is that that we didn't point out is that that you pointed out is that we do hear that ball bouncing. And then again, as I was discussing those shots back to back, that ball rolling in the field, like the sound of this ball is now gone, just like the sound of Elsie is gone. And that's something that, again, ties our points together and furthers the idea that first 10 minutes of this movie is pretty incredible.
Yeah, and so then once, and another thing that kind of runs throughout this movie too is that it's not a very violent movie. I mean, thematically it is, and it's kind of, you know, the worst kind of violence as our society looks at it. But yeah, you know, her death is really depicted by a balloon rolling away and a balloon floating into telephone wires. There's a lot of criminals in this movie, but we don't really see a lot of on-screen violence. It's one of those things I think we've talked about good violence and good horror movies is when it's left to your imagination. And that's one thing Fritz Lang says is, you know, I leave it to the audience to picture the worst kinds of things. You know, the violence that Becker, you know, has towards these children is never explained. You know, he says people say, oh, we've seen the bodies, you know, there's something about these crimes that we think are linked, you know, there's something about these disappearances that lead us to believe it's an abduction, but it's all, you know, very opaque what's been happening here. We just know that it has this weight to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. So after her disappearance, we get this very, very 1930s shot of the news being spread by the children, the newspaper boys coming out and selling all these papers to everybody.
Yeah, that scene literally starts with somebody calling out extra, extra. Yeah. That's how 1931 this is.
Mm-hmm. It's like the template of an old movie, yeah, exactly. You know, plot moving forward.
Yeah.
And kind of similar to something you've pointed out, we get somebody has posted another poster outside, and we have somebody reading it to the crowd because the print is just too fine for everybody to read, and it's a huge news story, so obviously there's a big crowd around it. And, you know, we have somebody reading the story so everyone can hear, and then, if I'm not mistaken, it kind of seamlessly cuts into that table of men all sitting around eating and drinking, and one person reading the news story to everybody, which, you know, eventually turns into an argument that we can talk about. But I thought that seemed pretty modern too, just the way that it's not quite a narrator, but these omnipotent voices cut between scenes. And that happens a few times, you know, that happens during that investigation, as you talked about. But it seemed like a really interesting audio choice in a movie that has a few of those.
Yeah, and I think what's meant to be done with what you're describing there is that it's sort of like this: the whole city's talking about this, like out in public, yeah. And then in private as well. It's like the only thing that we're talking about, to the point where there are stark accusations being directed at people who are probably friends, you know, like that yeah. happened in that scene, right? So, so yeah, you're right that it's interesting, and it's again not. To my knowledge, not a very 1931 move, you know, not a classical 1931 sort of move.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. And so, yeah, there's that that scene of what I can only imagine to be friends, or people who at least know each other well, because there's five people sitting at a table, you know, hearing this news be read mm-hmm. and discussing it. And yeah, some very, very bold accusations.
Yeah. Like,
there's, and so this is, you know, structurally, this is the scene, this and kind of a couple subsequent scenes is just meant to display the city kind of turning on itself in the way that friends are even turning on each other, and just the mass hysteria that is sweeping the city. Because then, you know, we see, I mean, we can talk more about that table scene too, but we see a pickpocket get arrested on a public bus, and someone says, oh, he says, you know, you have time to catch pickpockets, but you don't have time to catch the murderer. And then someone overhears murderer. And then,
yep.
you know, someone links it to this child murder story. And all of a sudden that this one guy who, you know, is a criminal, is a pickpocket, but is definitely not the child murderer. We know that mm-hmm. is, you know, almost being killed on the street. And it's this, this sort of mob rule, mob justice, you know, this chain of information and things just being misunderstood and blown out of proportion that is important in explaining just how the cops and the criminals are having to ramp this investigation up so quickly, just because it's understandably on everybody's mind and everyone's just on edge and the emotions are running so high in the city that, you know, this it can't function like this much longer.
No, exactly. And I think that the moment with the pickpocket is one of my favorite moments in this movie. I think it's so great, and it's just this quick moment that doesn't come out of nowhere, but comes out of somewhere very close to nowhere, is where it's just like the mob just overhears the word murderer, and immediately they're like, oh, he's the murderer, he's being arrested, like, we have to attack him immediately. And I think accusations are something that are a big part of this movie, and the way that this movie, not in this specific scene, but going back to that table sequence with those five men,
yeah,
five men sitting around. When those accusations start flying, we get cuts to people yelling directly in the camera, right? Like stare down the camera, like it's a POV shot from the person being accused. And there are moments of this movie where we're supposed to think, well, what would it feel like to have this pointed at us, or what would it feel like to have misinformation directed at us? And that's exactly what's happening to the pickpocket. We don't see that accusatory POV shot in that sequence necessarily, but we do see a situation where somebody is falsely accused of something. Again, a criminal, but still, there's a difference between stealing a wallet and killing a child. And the mob immediately, it's like that POV shot is now looking at 50 different people, all of whom are trying to kill him. You know, like that theoretical yeah. POV shot that is not in this movie, but the equivalent to it, you know?
Yeah, no, the close-up on the face is very confrontational, you know, looking right into the camera, looking right into your eyes, and having them scream at you and call you, like, not even just sort of a suspicion, but straight, like, he just calls him a murderer.
Yeah.
You know, it's, there's no
dancing around it in this
movie. Yeah, there's no ambiguity to it. And so, yeah, that's a certain kind of threatening, but then, as you said, when the pickpocket's coming off the bus, we don't get these shots of individual faces, but it's more frightening. You know, we just get him swallowed up by the mob. Yeah. We lose sight of these people just because there are 50 people yelling at you, and you you know, you can quickly see how this just turns into a lynch mob, or, you know, some kind of gigantic vigilante group that you know, carries out street justice. And, you know, we talked about the newspapers a little bit, you know, the boys selling newspapers and the reward signs and things like that. And we could talk about the media a bit more here. But just quickly, just think about the way misinformation spreads now when we have the ability to look things up. You know what I mean? Like, everyone has a fact-checking machine in their pocket, and you still see big ideas, you know, snowball into these insane theories.
Well, because that fact-checking machine is also a fact-spoiling machine, right? Like, it's, you know, if you're not looking in the right place, then it's not the correct fact, right?
Well, true. But, I mean, imagine that you didn't even have the ability to try to look it up. You know what I mean? That any, even the most discerning person, you can imagine, you know, you or I could just get caught up in the street. You know, if people's children were being abducted and being killed, and it seems like everyone around you is pretty sure that this is the guy right here, you know, it's, you can absolutely see how you would have the exact same emotions that these people do, and with no way to verify that, you know, you're very much just at the very much a victim to your emotions and the emotions of everyone around you.
Yep, true.
And so, yeah, as I said, that I think pretty soon after this, we get that scene in sort of the criminal hangout, right? I haven't skipped anything major you wanted to touch on?
No, I don't think so, because I think a big portion of this movie is it's just scene. Like, that scene with the pickpocket is very quick and just sort of there's no clear explanation of really what's happening. It just happens fast, and then you're just like, oh, mob justice, and then boom, they're on to the next thing. I think somewhere in the middle, we see that those shots of Beckert writing his next letter, and that's what sort of gets us to the conversation between the commissioner and whoever the other person on the other side of that phone call is, which leads us to the fingerprint analysis and everything.
Right.
That's sort of the way that we get a you know, a signifier that more time has passed. You know, he's had time to write another letter, and that for that letter to get published and for people to be upset about that being published. You know?
Yeah, so, right.
Yeah. And that's basically, that's the moment that sort of gives us a line between what are two semi-montages, you know?
So. Yeah, and we did touch on it, but that shot of the map with sort of the wider concentric circles as they expand their investigation.
Yeah.
So good.
Yes, I agree. You're coming to the MacGuffin Men for hot takes, like Fritz Lang knows how to direct a movie.
Right.
That's what we're known for. Yeah. But yes, I agree. And I think the thing that bears mentioning about the, or I guess this is the cops and criminals, their conversations, their private conversations being intercut, is they're kind of having different versions of the same conversation. You pointed it out a little bit that they're both for different reasons. They're like, we have to catch this guy. Like, we can't run our operation like this, you know, from the cop's perspective, the like mob justice is going to take over at some point. I mean, not mafia justice specifically, but that's kind of what they're dealing with as well. And then from the mob side of things, or the criminal side of things, it's like, there's so many cops out there that we can't get anything done, you know.
The shot of their like of what's left at the bar after the cops show up, so they just have to ditch everything.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I love a time period when just stealing silverware is still like it's brass knuckles and guns and, you know, burglar tools, but then just several spoons, which are nicer than what you have at home.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, the way that they're linked together is really interesting. And specifically, there's this one moment, I think it's probably the first time that we cut between from the criminals to the cops, is the guy who's leading the meeting sort of moves his arm, like gestures to the other people in the room. And when that happens, we get a cut to the police. And the police, whoever's leading their meeting, is making the same arm movement. Like, it's like, I now gesture to everybody else in the group. But the idea of that cut is that however far apart these people are within this city, these two polar opposite sort of organizations are focused on the same thing, and they're coming at it from different angles, but they still, the only thing that matters in the city is catching Beckert, you know?
Yeah. So I think this is one of the main things I really want to talk about in this movie is that scene, which, I mean, it's cut together so well for some of the reasons you pointed out, of just aligning these two different factions, you know, the cops and the criminals. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we see get played with quite often, you know, I think for good reasons. You know, the Wire, you know, a lot of things that we really, really like that we find interesting, mm-hmm. definitely make a lot of hay out of this notion of aligning these two things that, you know, are supposed to be diametrically opposed. What do you think that M's trying to say, though? Is it just trying to point, is the function of those scenes just to say these two groups are both motivated to get Beckert now? Or are we supposed to see that is this supposed to align the cops as being crooked or less likable? Or are we supposed to have sympathy or like the criminals a bit more? Like, what's this juxtaposition meant to do? Are we supposed to be kind of looking at them at the same side of the coin, or like what is it trying to make a statement about, do you think?
So the way that I perceive it, and I don't think it's trying to make a specific statement. I think it gives you enough on both sides to sort of make your own, form your own thoughts. You know, it's not, I don't think the police in general are shown as some sort of like big corrupt organization that has no control over the situation. But it's also not demonized at all. Like later when that safecracker is being interrogated but at the police station, we get this cutaway shot of...
Franz? Safecracker is sort of their like lead criminal.
The guy who gets caught and...
Yeah, that's Franz. Okay.
Franz, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so when he's... And he eventually gives up the location where Beckert is. During that conversation, there's a cutaway to a shot that is totally unrelated to this interrogation. It's just a guy, like a cop, sitting at this giant table with a big old beer and a million sausages in front of him, just like eating food. And it seems to... That seems to me to be about like almost this... ignorance of what's happening around him because he just wants to sit and eat his food. You know, that sort of, to me, that shot is about like there can be people within this organization that are not trying as hard as they should, you know, because it looks like, I mean, it's a bigger meal than I've eaten in 4 years, you know, and I eat very large meals. So it's, I don't know, I think that's sort of meant to show an ignorance of the situation. And I don't think there's something similar with the criminals. But I do think the idea of this movie throughout is not necessarily to point fingers and say, this is true for sure. It's to direct you in a certain way and let you form your own opinions on these organizations, the criminals, the cops, even Beckert himself, you know?
Yeah, okay. So a few things there. I think that those cuts that you're talking about when Franz is being interrogated, mm-hmm. is that's the night watchman that they're saying is dead now.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So he like, just to point this out as well, this movie is not without humor. This movie that is 100%, about a child murderer and the way he's terrorizing a city. There's definitely jokes throughout this. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one thing that I like about it. Not that it is just super funny, because that's not it. But it's just I like a movie that has the confidence to not just be heavy wall to wall and rely on that as a way to be powerful. I think this movie is extremely powerful and also is aware that sometimes life is funny. And, you know, this is just an accurate depiction of that. And so I think that that is Fran, you know, because they set a trap for him because they say, you know, he's a criminal, but he's not a murderer. This is a guy who will steal things, but would never want, like, he would do anything to get out of being accused of a crime this heavy. So even the death of the night watchman, not of the child. Mm-hmm. So they cut to the watchman that he's being told is dead, and he's very much not dead. He's enjoying one of several comically oversized glasses of beer that we see throughout this movie.
And I think that's even bigger than the comically oversized glass of beer that we'd see previously.
Because that argument of those five guys, they're drinking hilariously huge steins, and the guy has like a huge cigar holder with a huge cigar. Mm-hmm. But that's my understanding of that. And there are a couple moments that it does seem like for example, it doesn't seem as though we see that the cops are being displayed as really crooked or really inept. You know, this doesn't seem like it's a entirely corrupt police force who doesn't care about the citizens, and that's why this child murderer is still free. It seems like most of these people are extremely hardworking, and you know, they're not getting bribed or anything like that. You know what I mean? But then we do see glimpses. You know, there seems to be this disdain for the public. You know, when they're having that meeting we talked about. Talking about getting clues from the citizens, and they're, you know, I'm guessing something like a captain or the equivalent says, you know, it makes me sick hearing about the public trying to help us. You know, he talks about how dumb they are and how stupid their hints are, and that they're useless in an investigation. So, you know, that doesn't look great on them.
I think that, sorry, continue your point.
Yeah, and similarly, when they do bust that that, you know, criminal hangout bar, they sort of Lohman, you know, the lead police officer there at the time, is pretty loose about what is going to get you sent to the station. You know, they're checking everybody's papers, but he seems to kind of come up with a reason just to send everybody there, even if it looks like their story really checks out. Mm-hmm. So there are these things that you know, seem like, you know, mild disdain for the public, small abuses of police power, but it's really not these really big things. It's not a sweeping indictment of every police officer. It's not pointing out how corrupt the people at the top are. It's these things, but they're kind of small. And then even with the criminals, we don't get this thing where, oh, they're noble. You know, they want to catch this child killer because they're disgusted by it and want to save the children. They're motivated by the fact that they can't continue their life of criminality. And they do some moralizing, saying, you know, we commit crimes, but nothing like this. We would never kill children. You know, we have something of a code. But you don't get the extreme version of that where, you know, we're all so poor, we can't make a living. There's institutional problems about why we have to resort to this life of crime. You know, it really doesn't swing both ways, which is something like swing to the extreme ends of the pendulum, which some other movies and TV shows, when they want to kind of play with these ideas of flipping the cops and criminals, sort of lean on. And so it's interesting.
It's like James Cromwell is the police commissioner, but he's also the head of the mob and or whatever the villain side of things is in LA Confidential. You know, like there's none of that in
LA. Exactly. Yeah. And I've seen Fritz Lang described as a moral director, but not a moralizing director. You know, he's not so blatant about this is what you should believe. I'm going to really take this ham-fisted approach to things. And, you know, just the notion of subtlety and nuance when it's such an early example in the art form, I think, is even harder to do because, you know, you don't have great examples of it and you're kind of used to telling more simple stories, I guess. So I think that the way that it doesn't swing for the fences on these things and kind of puts ideas out there. And like you said, just sort of presents them and lets you sort of make what you want of them a bit more, I think is something that has to be noted, just because it's it doesn't really speak down to the audience. And you and I are always happy to have that in our entertainment.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. And I think it just sort of presents these two groups as large organizations. And I think the problems that they are sort of discussing are, I think, problems that make sense for these specific large organizations to be talking about. And when you talk about how the cops are complaining about how the public is dumb and never helps anybody, like, it's almost like you're working with another, if you're a part of a company, you're working with another company and you're just talking shit about the other company, you know, like yeah. In the cops case, the other company is always the public. Like, it's the only the only group that they're working. I mean, I guess it's the public or the government. Like, those are the two groups that you're working with, right? And I think that sort of thing is important to point out. And I assume cops complain about people all the, like, the public all the time, because it's something standing in the way of them doing the job the way they want to do the job, you know? And
yeah, and they're kind of your customers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In what job does nobody complain about their customers?
Yeah, and exactly. And you know, different versions of the same thing for the criminals. And one thing that I do think is worth pointing out, and I saw, so when we are introduced to Beckert, we're introduced via him walking in a frame in a shadow, right? Like, you remember, yeah. Elsie's bouncing the ball against the reward posting. He yep. steps in a frame, he's a shadow, has a conversation with Elsie. Later, when we're getting these intercut cops and criminals discussions, when the criminals decide that we have to get him ourselves, we get this cut to three shadows on the wall, three or four shadows on the wall, however many people are in frame. And that's the moment they decide, like, we have to get this guy ourselves. And so we do also see the criminals linked with Beckert. Again, a lot of time passes in between these two moments, but we do see them as shadow figures, not unlike Beckert. And I didn't see an example of that happening with police. That doesn't mean it's not there. I thought of this like 5 minutes before we started recording, so I didn't have time to scrape through the whole movie and check. But I did think that was worth noting, is that if the police aren't identified by a shadow at any point in the movie, then maybe it's saying the police are above these criminals, because then you're not linking it with Beckert, or linking them with Beckert at all. But it was just something that caught my eye that I thought was interesting.
There's something similar to that I think is easy to miss, that it's when the criminals are, it's the first meeting that they're having and they're waiting for the safecracker to show up. Mm-hmm. They're sort of their lead there. They're worried that maybe he's been caught, and someone's saying that he's really good at not getting caught. He's so good at what he does and getting away with it. And there's one time that he was in London and Scotland Yard had him up against the wall, and all of a sudden those two cops are corpses and he's gone. And yeah, this movie isn't, as I said, it's really not trying to nobilize the criminals at all. You know, they're very gleeful when they're talking about these two bodies. And you know, those are two cops who, for all we know, are just doing their job. You know, their only sin is trying to stop criminals. Mm-hmm. It's really flippant. They don't lean on it at all. You know, he's not saying, oh, and I'm so glad those pigs died or whatever. You know, it's just, this was this kind of really cool thing. And it was two seemingly innocent people who died. And I think that this movie, you know, for all those things it does about trying to align cops and criminals and, you know, look at them as the two important forces working within this movie, it doesn't really, I don't really think it's putting, you know, the institution of law enforcement on trial by any means. It's still, I think, generally a conservative movie by the end of it. Mm-hmm. You know, for all those ideas that it plays with and presents and sort of, as we said, allows you to draw some of your own conclusions, it doesn't feel like it's subversive. You know, it doesn't feel like this is saying the cops are corrupt and that the people should act this way and that mob justice is the answer. I think it shows how, as you know, action like this to take place within the streets, you know, with citizens and with the criminal element, but it's not glorifying it.
No, no, I agree. I would sort of push back a little bit on the idea that this movie isn't subversive at the end. I think in 1939, giving a child serial killer any sort of humanistic lean, which I think this movie does.
31, yeah.
Yeah, I think that is subversive in comparison for the time, you know?
Yeah, okay, that's right. I was looking at it in a different element, but I think that is, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, treating a murderer of children as anything other than just, like, kill him immediately in 1931, I think that can be noted as subversive for sure.
Yeah, I think that's pretty subversive now.
Yes, also true. Good point.
Yeah. And so then I'm trying to just follow this through, because I think it is interesting what you've said about the structure of this movie and the way that it doesn't really adhere to a three act structure perfectly. So I'm just trying to do this linearly. Mm-hmm. I guess at this point we're with sort of Beckard on the street looking for his next victim. Once it's been determined that, I guess we have the criminals decide to mobilize the beggars union. And we get a very kind of amazing shot of the, I don't even know how to describe it, the homeless headquarters. I'm not sure what it is there, but that's just another piece of kind of very well put together filmmaking. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And just the way that the camera is sort of, this is when the camera is swinging around from the shots of the silverware to the shots of the food to the shots of the card game, like all in one shot.
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about? Yeah.
Zooming through the window.
Oh, so yes, exactly. Those are two different shots. The push in through the window is, it's linked to that previous shot, but they're in a different location, I think, or an upper version of the same location. And that's where people are lined up out the door to go on the table or to walk up to this table and have their papers checked or whatever. Honestly, not 100% clear to me, because I was just like, oh, that's a cool, super cool camera move. And this is 1931. That's incredibly difficult. Like, anytime a camera is moving on a crane and you're seeing a pan, like if you're seeing a pan in this movie, it's difficult to do, you know? Like,
yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that's a cool shot now, let alone all the restrictions that they'd be under at the time.
Exactly. And again, to explain this for the millionth time, is just the cameras are larger. You need more lights because film is not as fast. So you need more equipment just to get an exposure, and the equipment just in general is less advanced, you know? And those are very cool shots. And yeah, like you said, I think this is where the movie sort of transitions into a point where it's more action-based, and we get the following sequence. And there's honestly, like, I have less to say about this 40-minute period of the movie than any other part of the movie, just because it seems pretty self-explanatory. Because we get the following, and then we get the scene where they're trying to catch him in that building, you know? And basically, until you get to the courtroom sequence, it's more straightforward and less... easier to follow, I guess, than the first 40 minutes of the movie, right? You
know? Yeah, I guess.
It's more traditional, I think. More traditional storytelling.
Yeah.
To an extent.
I agree. I still find that part super compelling. I know you're
It's definitely compelling. I just mean, like, as far as... That's the segment of the movie where I took the least amount of notes, you know?
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. This movie is compelling start to finish.
Yeah. No, and so, yeah, that's... That's where we are. It's also just a plot. Like, I know that there are movies where the criminals and the police are going after somebody, but I'm surprised that this isn't copied more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially this part, which, as you said, you could do without so many of the interesting ideas, without some of the really interesting filmmaking techniques. Mm-hmm. That part is really interesting to me. There is one scene that I definitely want to get to that we'd skip over if we got right to this part now.
Yeah, the cafe.
Yeah.
It's that scene is something.
What do you mean?
Well, number one, I think we're both noted fans of Peter Lorre when we did our Maltese Falcon podcast. He's Joel Cairo in the Maltese Falcon, and he's the, I think, highlight of that movie to me.
And I think he's pretty undeniable as a performer. Like, that, we're not the first people to point out.
No, exactly. And But I think that cafe scene is very important in that it's the, we get him in between, we get him after following one child. It's the child who eventually meets her mom halfway or whatever. And so his plans are foiled there. And then he's sitting by himself at the cafe and he wants a coffee. No, a vermouth. No, a cognac. And then another cognac. And just the way that he is sort of... that this movie shows him sitting at a table struggling with what he was about to do right before he goes and does the same, like actually succeeds, you know, at what he's, or tries again is fascinating. And what we were saying about this movie being subversive for humanizing this type of person at all. That's as, I think, as humanized as he gets, even when he's using, when he has his big speech later, it's just, I mean, that's more hitting the nail on the head sort of thing. But yeah. This moment is just like, this is a person alone with their thoughts and struggling with the idea that they are a person who murders children. And it's just like, I don't think I have seen this on film before, you know? and I can understand why no filmmaker wants to put that on film, you know? It's,
yeah. Don't want to look sympathetic to somebody who's a child murderer, but
yeah, exactly. And I think that the movie, I think M does a good job of showing this, sort of like when the, so he sits down at the table, starts his order, and he's sitting behind this sort of like bush, right? Or this hedge.
I'll call it a trellis.
Okay.
Which that is like a structure with a plant growing on it.
Yes. You are the nature expert of the two of us, noted famously. And and so he's sitting in front of this trellis and he makes his order and we're still kind of in a wide shot, but the camera starts to push in, right? And we're sort of getting closer to him physically, because the idea is this is more personality than we've seen out of this person to this point.
He's not just this looming figure that's taking victims. He's someone who exists outside of his crimes.
Exactly. He's not the shadow as Elsie bounces the ball on the reward thing anymore. Now we can see his face, but we still can't see him clearly, right? Because we're as you said, the camera is still looking at him through this trellis, right? We're never really seeing him head on. And as he's getting up to leave, the camera pulls back. So we're getting further away from him physically again, as he's about to go try and do the same thing again. And I just thought that was, again, I've seen I have no comparison point for it. And I don't know, it was fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's a few things here. I mean, it's, you know, there's some, you know, vegetation on this trellis. There's like some leaves growing on it. And so you kind of get this imagery of him being sort of like a predator, you know, like a wolf in the woods, you know, trying to, find his next victim sort of. And so, yeah. And as you said, it's this moment where we look at him, not just as something that's going to kill somebody else, but an individual who has his own life, even when he's not, committing the crimes that make him notable for, you know, the rest of society. Mm-hmm. And he does his whistling thing, you know, he does the Peer Gynt song that we've come to associate with him, which we also come to associate with his, you know, his heinous crimes. But he seems to be fighting it here. You know, this is a moment where he seems to be battling with this compulsion that he has. It's not just who he is 100% of the time. He does seem to have a grip that, these actions are unacceptable. You know, this is a very immoral, awful thing to do, to put it lightly. And he feels like he doesn't want to do it, and he's battling it. And even just the inability to order a drink, you know, he has these incompatible thoughts at once. You know, he wants a coffee, he wants a vermouth, he wants a brandy, he wants to not commit crimes, but he has to commit crimes. And even this moment of him alone, that we're supposed to really sort of experience his interiority and have sort of a clear view of who he is beyond this, we don't get a clear shot of him. We don't see him clearly. I think we're meant to understand he doesn't see himself clearly. He never has this one person that he's happy to be. He has this, you know, these pro-social values that he was probably raised with to, you know, respect life and to not commit murder. But then he has this, you know, who knows where it came from, but this other part of him, this compulsion to do these, you know, these awful things. And it's a super brief scene, and I think it does so much. And as you said, for them to be giving this, I don't even know if sympathy is the right word, but at least this much dynamic range to a character that we're just supposed to see as, you know, the big bad. That's super interesting for right now, let alone for the time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the, you know, there's so many examples of, I mean, basically, like, Silence of the Lambs is, again, the easiest one to point to. It's where we're getting inside the mind of a killer. And I know Clarice isn't actually chasing Hannibal Lecter, but their in that movie, but their conversations are get in the mind of a killer sort of conversations. But, and they're creepy in their own way, but they're creepy in like a charming way. And this is creepy in, like, with M, it's horrifying and creepy because it's not, I don't know, there's nothing particularly charismatic about Beckard. Whereas I think in most serial killer movies, it's like, we see the serial killer again, Kevin Spacey as John Doe is another one that comes to mind. It's like, there's a type of terrifying charisma to them. Whereas this guy is just, Peter Lorre's playing it like he's just somebody who has compulsions. And I think we get that all played out in the speech at the end. And it's just, I don't know. And I think that's what makes it stand apart from sort of, our old friend Stephen Benedict mentioned this in his podcast on M about how it shows the quote unquote murky depths of the criminal mind. But this is showing those murky depths in a way that is more, I think Beckard is more closely aligned in that scene to a regular human being than somebody like Hannibal Lecter or John Doe ever is, you know? And
yeah.
And again, we both understand why a filmmaker would not want to tackle this scene, you know?
Yeah. And even within this film, I mean, at the beginning, you know, that shot of him, of just his shadow over the poster advertising his reward and the nature of his crimes, you know, that's literally very one dimensional, you know, it's just, it's his shadow. And then this, you know, after the cafe scene, we see him out on the street and he's looking at himself in the reflection, you know, it's just this clear moment of self-reflection. He's kind of playing with his face a few times throughout this movie, like he's trying to make himself look, I think, scarier. You know, he kind of has like a frown that he's doing with his hands, you know, to manipulating his face to look less normal. And I think he's trying to see the monster that other people see in him. And then, unlike what is the killer's name in Silence of the Lambs?
Buffalo Bill.
Buffalo Bill. Yeah, there it is. When we see him taking victims, you know, when he's trying to get that woman into his van, which he's successful in doing, he goes out with this plan. He pretends to have a broken arm and he pretends to be moving this furniture on his own and pretends to need help and then ends up taking a victim. Whereas this one, we see Beckard on the street and he sees this young girl and that's the motivation. You know, he's not like, I'm going to go out and do this because it's what I like to do. He is just compelled. And,
yeah, that's true. And the other example that we've been going back to, Seven, is like the man with the plan. So, like, he plans 365 days in advance for one of these deaths, you know? Like,
right.
So, yeah, exactly. That is a good point to make.
Yeah, he's just looking at himself in the mirror and then he catches the reflection of this young girl. And, you know, that's, and then we even see I don't know if it's a toy store or a bookstore or something, but that spiral and the big arrow that's moving and, you know, it's this kind of, you know, mesmerized, disorienting moment. But then there's also just this big arrow, like you're kind of lost in where he is mentally. But then there's this gigantic signifier of it's right here. Like this is it. This is the person. This is the moment kind of thing. And, you know, they don't have her stand under it for a long period of time. It's not a super ham-fisted sort of way to do it. But we just have these gigantic symbols of, you know, disorientation and focus. And, you know, that the idea that he's just walking around literally looking at his reflection, trying to figure himself out, and then sees a thing and sees this person, and can't control himself, I think is a different kind of killer than we normally see in things that you might put in the same category.
Yeah, absolutely. All good points. I have no disagreement.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, and so then we're in the office or the big building that they're closing in on him now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, cool sequence, and I don't have much more. <You know? laughs> Like, it's a good compelling sequence, and And I think it's good that this movie has almost, I don't want to call it a chase, but elements of a chase. You know, it's not a car chase. They're not covering a lot of physical ground, but it is engaging. And I think too, if the whole movie had just been montage after montage of cops hanging out and talking to each other and criminals hanging out and talking to each other, it would get pretty bland. But this is sort of a more physical sort of representation of the chase, and it was very, very engaging, very entertaining.
Yeah, and then the sort of the lack of sound here, you know, this is they say it's a city of 4 million, you know, this seems to be like the downtown core, but I find the way that the sound drops out, and you know, I think this is after all those things we've just talked about, where we're kind of getting more of an understanding of who Beckard is. And I think at this point, he does become the protagonist. You know, he's the character that we know most about. He has the most screen time, I imagine. And, you know, we're meant to not completely, you know, we're not rooting for him, but we're definitely meant to sympathize with him more. And so he's being chased down, and just the way that the sound disappears, you know, there's all these other things just disappear. Right now, it's him trying to get away, and him, you know, there's no sound, like the faraway buses or people talking no longer mean anything to this character. It's really just a fight for survival and to escape.
Yeah, for sure. And I would sort of, my guess is that there's some sort of curfew that's been placed on the city as well. I think that would probably explain some of the, it seems like something that would have happened, and explains a little bit of why the sound isn't there. And then also, I mean, if you're running away from people, one of the main things that you're trying not to do is be hurt. You know, if they don't know where you are, then how many times have you seen a movie where someone accidentally kicks a rock and they're like, oh no, now they know where I am, you know? Yeah. So I think that's another, there's two reasons, one practical, one thematic, as to why sound drops out.
Yeah. No, that's right. Yeah. And then, yeah, we have this sort of sequence of them, of the criminals get there first. The building's on lockdown as it's closed, and they have taken care of the security guards. And so it's really just them piecing apart this building and trying to find Beckard where he's hidden. And as you said, this is sort of a more straightforward sort of action-y or you know, plot moving along thing, and maybe less packed with some of the ideas. Still some interesting filmmaking, but
oh, for sure.
Like that shot of, I mean, so they have him by the time they the police get there, and Franz is stuck down that hole. You know, there's sort of the last criminal that gets left there in the confusion after the silent alarm's been tripped. That overhead shot of the hole and the, you know, him climbing up the rope after the cops have come out, I think that one really stands out to me as just a kind of an image that I really like from that sequence. Anything else for you?
I think it stood out to Wes Anderson as well when he was making the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Oh, I guess that's true. Oh, yeah.
There are a couple things in this movie that remind me of the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is funny to say about a movie. The Grand Budapest Hotel is like a half a kid's movie, sort of, you know? And yeah. I mean, like every Wes Anderson movie is half a children's movie. But that this is a movie about killing children, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I watched that recently, and I didn't even make that connection. That's a good one.
Well, and I think the toy store is called Henkel's, and the bakery in the Grand Budapest Hotel is called Mendel's. And there's a camera move when Franz is walking in to be interrogated. There's a camera move that's very reminiscent of something that happens with Tom Wilkinson in the intro. So yeah, there's your quick Grand Budapest Hotel analysis from me that may or may not be found in reality. But the shot where Franz is looking up is for sure an inspiration for the Grand Budapest Hotel.
I can picture the shot now that you say it, but I hadn't pieced that together.
Even the aspect ratio of that movie matches, which is uncommon for a movie in 2014 and a movie in 1931.
Huh. Well, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. So, yes. But yeah, that is that's the shot that really jumped out at me. And but again, the whole sequence is interesting, and the combination of that and the police trying to slowly figure out what they were actually doing, like why are they breaking into this bank but not touching the safe, you know, like that, I think that is an interesting moment to me.
Yeah, you know? Oh yeah, so, no, I love that.
Yeah, so
yeah, and then cool. We sort of have Franz's interrogation that we've we touched on a little bit, and this is all while Beckert is I think at the old distillery or at the old brewery outside of town with lots and lots of criminals.
Yeah,
and
lots of criminals, very few of whom are guarding the door.
Yeah. Well, and
that's a classic 1931 sort of moment. It's like, we have a million people in this room, but we're not going to guard the one place you can exit out of, you know?
Yeah. And the other, I mean, talk about Peter Lorre too, just mm-hmm. being so expressive, and like he'll do 40 different emotions in a second, mm-hmm. which I think is very kind of 1930s sort of,
definitely
coming from silent film. And I mean, Peter Lorre was also doing a play nightly while mm-hmm. shooting this, mm-hmm. which is incredible, because yeah. shooting films is not a short day, let alone to go do, you know, what I assume is at least a 2-hour play somewhere else at night. Is
yeah,
pretty
well,
incredible.
When we did a podcast on Glengarry Glen Ross, I mentioned that Jonathan Pryce was shooting his scenes of Glengarry Glen Ross during the day and then going to Broadway to perform Miss Saigon, you know, which is also, like, again, for the same reason, incredible, you know, like, it's just,
yeah.
Seems like such a difficult day. I think doing one of those two things is impossible for me to wrap my head around, let alone both in a day.
Yeah, so his kind of highly expressive face sometimes is a little too much for me, but, you know, can't blame him. Mm-hmm. And just
that's also his style is also a product of the time too, right?
No, that's what I mean, like, yeah. Doing silent film and doing plays, you would just have to be so expressive, and yeah. doing so many comedies before this, like, he just has such a wildly kind of rubbery face and the big bulging eyes, like, it works for who he is in this movie, but it's such a big look. And
yeah, it's just like, if you took the movie stars of the 1990s and in the 1930s, I think the only one that would succeed is Jim Carrey, because he's the only one that can move, like, has a face that can move like that, right? So.
Yeah, and the other kind of 1930s one, since we're talking about Fran's interrogation there, is when he admits to, you know, what, that they're for Beckert, and then the cigarette comes out of his face and he still reaches for it. Like, that is such Chaplin,
oh yeah,
Buster Keaton, silly silent comedy gag, but as you said, product of the times. Mm-hmm. And so in Beckert's panic there, when he's you know, he walks to that door and he turns around and he sees the kangaroo court that the mob has assembled, he's shocked. I am genuinely surprised too, like, as a viewer, I just absolutely not what I expect there.
Yeah.
An interesting shot, just this kind of slow pan, I guess, of, you know, 100 people all kind of staggered making this big kind of jury and counsel and, you know, courtroom audience. And it's just another either almost completely silent or completely silent moment. And you just sort of take it in. And yeah, just another way that we get aligned with him, just the complete shock and fear. And, you know, if it was three people, he would have every right to be absolutely terrified about what's going to happen to him. And then the fact that it's such a large, well-staged group, I think makes it such a great shot and such a great moment.
Absolutely. I agree.
And then we kind of have a pretty long scene here. You know, it's this, as I said, sort of this kangaroo court where he's put on trial for his child murders that he hasn't at this point confessed to, that they're not sure even is him. You know, it's one blind man heard him whistle a song, and so they put a letter on him, and now he's basically been convicted of multiple child murders. But
I mean, as we've learned in this movie, it doesn't take much to be accused.
No.
But also, like, in this case, we do want to clarify that they are actually right.
No, 100%. 100%. He has done these things. And yeah, then we get, as I said, kind of right off the top, we get this very interesting and, like, once again, to me, unexpected and pleasantly surprised sort of meditation on, you know, the idea of free will and how responsible we are for our actions and mental health and criminal compulsion versus choosing a criminal lifestyle. And it's just, to me, it was absolutely not what I was expected would, you know, maybe those ideas would have been played with sort of indirectly in this movie, but the way that they do it and really kind of spell it out. And again, we've talked about how we'd like that it's not really hitting the nail over the head. This is pretty correct. You know, this is legitimately like a philosophical debate just playing out in front of us for a certain point. But I think it's wonderful. I mean, I like kind of ethical philosophy and stuff. So this scene is just, it's so wonderful to me.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. And again, don't want to seem like we're sympathizing with the person who has murdered children. But like, it's, again, not very 1931 to humanize a criminal at all, let alone a child murderer. As you said, this type of criminal, it's not very 2020 to humanize this person at all. You know, it's just not done. These are people who are not humans to us. And watching him run through his whole thing about how he's compelled and how he's making the argument that the criminals across from him are criminals by choice. They chose to learn a trade like safe cracking or whatever. And he is compelled to do these things. And the other, I think, something that has to enter your mind is this guy is now very terrified for his life. And I don't know that he's necessarily being 100% honest in this situation either. Right. Yeah. And I think that's something that needs to be pointed out. But I think that we see that scene of him in the cafe is very important earlier, because it sort of gives us at least a little bit of a tie into the idea that even what he's saying is at least partially true about himself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the lawyer is really interesting. His appointed lawyer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he immediately pushes back on he argues for, like, he makes kind of a pro mental health argument, which is, I did not see coming in a 1931 movie. You know, he's talking about how his crimes are so vile that he shouldn't even be considered a human who is responsible for his own actions, and he has to go to, he uses the word asylum, and pushes back against the judge, as the judge has three counts of manslaughter on him, or is wanted for three counts of manslaughter, maybe. And I don't know, just the whole conversation is really fascinating, like, in ways that, like, I don't think we can really elucidate why it's fascinating more than just listen to this conversation. You know, it's pretty clear, you know. And I think the thing that and also that mother who speaks out towards the very end, like, we sort of get the perspective of the victim in there as well, again very briefly and nowhere near as long as the perpetrator of the crime, but it's still just a very interesting scene. And I think something that is worth noting is when Francis telling the police where this is happening, he mentions that this building is, like you said, probably a brewery or something, but it's something that went, a building that went belly up in the Depression is what he uses. And Germany in the 1920s was in a horrible economic depression. Like, famously, people had to carry, you know, there's a famous comic of wheelbarrows of money being involved to purchase a loaf of bread. And I think that they're in this sort of signifying place of government failure, I think, is sort of adds another layer to the idea of the police are the representation of the organization, like the people who are supposed to watch over us, the people who are supposed to protect us. And I think tying that into Germany in the late 1920s, early 1930s is worth noting, that they're in this sort of like mausoleum of how things used to be, you know, and that they feel a compulsion to take things under control themselves. You know, I think that's the thing that the movie doesn't really hit you over the head with, that is worth pointing out about that scene. You know?
Yeah, no, I think so. And earlier when we were talking about criminals sort of making this choice, you know, these criminals versus Beckert, you know, having an option to do something else, that, yeah, it's not by coincidence that they mentioned that this was a result of the entire economy falling apart, and that this is very much a time and place. You know, the global economy suffered during,
of course.
1929, but the idea that Germany was already in such an economic state that, and then this happens on top of it, that, yeah, I think it's absolutely right of you to mention that this was specifically a place specifically aligned with you know, such an incredible economic collapse.
Yeah, exactly. And these are the, I guess I didn't make it clear that it's the, what happened to Germany is the after effects of World War One. And I, my understanding is that he also took a large loan from the United States. And once the stock market crashed in 1929, you said, the United States immediately demanded that money back, which sent a country that was already in a depression into an even worse depression, you know? So And that's kind of where we're at. And I think that does something to humanize the people sitting across from Beckert a little bit. It's like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, you kind of understand people being pushed to crime in that situation.
Yeah. And so that, and that's a bit more like, that's, I think, a correct reading, but it's a bit more in the subtext. You know, they mention it, but it's not, you know, there's no big speech about that. But we do have this very direct sort of debate, as we said, about how to look at a criminal like this and how to consider mental health when adjudicating someone's fate like this. And it, I mean, it reminds me of the end of the Great Dictator, the Chaplin movie we've talked about, that mm-hmm. he has this, you know, his is even a direct address to camera. You know, he kind of just stares right into the lens and says what he really feels. And I find that part really powerful, I'm sure I mentioned. And I think this whole, you know, his whole speech, him being a very great performer and just having this scene to really sell it.
It's an Oscar montage speech, you know, like it's a,
oh yeah,
it's Mark Ruffalo in Spotlight saying we knew for years, you know, like it's when he's nominated for an Academy Award. That's the clip they show.
Yeah, no, it's the kind of the actor's dream thing. But I think that stuff, I mean, talk about Spotlight if you want here, but I think if it's a movie that you don't feel compelled by up until that point,
100%,
that stuff just does not roll very well.
Yeah.
But if you've just been watching what you kind of, you know, a movie that you felt compelled by, a movie that you think has had these really interesting pieces of storytelling, that, you know, it's someone behind the camera and, you know, the cast and crew that you think are extremely talented, who have put together something really good, and that you've already sort of bought the ticket, now this is the ride, that kind of really direct storytelling, or, you know, philosophizing, just has the intended effect. You know, if you're on board, then this stuff is certainly a lot more palatable and really just interesting and emotionally engaging and thought provoking. And I think that for all the reasons we've listed up until this point, you're very on board for this.
Yeah, exactly. And it, all the things that the movie does subtly to that point build to this scene.
Right.
And I mean the scene from both Beckert's point of view and also the point of view of the judge is the other person who speaks the most. But, you know, it's Beckert's big scene for sure. But the reason that it doesn't bother us and doesn't annoy us is because the movie has laid the groundwork, you know, it's like, and laid the groundwork in a way that isn't spelling it out for us for the whole movie. Yeah.
And then eventually the cops sort of show up just in time before the mob takes its own form of justice.
Yeah.
And so we have the scene where they're in the proper courtroom, and then the mother speaks, and that the, finally kind of says her piece, and we get that sort
Elsie's
of,
mother specifically.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then we get that cut to black with that last bit of audio. Is there anything you want to say about that scene?
I think it's really fascinating that we see so much of the kangaroo court, in your words, and none of the actual court. Like we see judges sitting down, and then it's like, fuck it, we don't need this scene. Like we've had it all, and it's like, and that we cut to a woman we haven't seen in almost like 100 minutes, you know,
yeah.
and we're just reminded of the human toll of all of this, you know, and she's just, I mean, it's a direct address to the camera, pretty much. It's her saying like, I don't care, this doesn't matter, and, you know, Elsie's gone. And I don't know, I thought that was a really interesting choice, and something that again, this movie absolutely has laid the groundwork for, and as such, it succeeds.
Yeah. I think that's it.
That's all I got too. Yeah, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week. We'll presumably be talking about something slightly more uplifting.